Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Each episode is a conversation with inspiring people who make wonderful contributions to our knowledge in these areas and spark curiosity and ideas to pursue. Join me, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
Probably the most important thing is that you need to have emotional awareness. You need to get in touch with your emotions. You need to figure out where and how they're driving you to make some regrettable decisions, because our emotions are all driving us to make some regrettable decisions sometime. You need to be able to identify that, those cognitive biases, those dangerous judgment errors, step away from them, and employ simple, effective, yet counterintuitive strategies to make the best decisions for your goals. And that all stems from emotional awareness of your feelings, of your mind, and that's what you really need to get in touch with.
Hi there, innovator. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. And I hope you enjoyed my recent conversations with Kate Billing, founder and creative director of Blacksmith, and with Iman Zabi of Scribesmith. I'm really excited today to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Dr. Gleb Sipirsky of Disaster Avoidance Experts. He's also author of Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters. In this book, Gleb focuses on the dangerous judgment errors known as cognitive biases in business leadership and reveals how leaders can overcome these mental blind spots to make the wisest and most profitable decisions. A quick promotional message from our sponsor, that's InnovaBiz, where we help coaches and consultants build professional credibility, engage their target audience, and connect with their ideal client. That requires absolute clarity about who your ideal clients are and how you can help them. To help you get that clarity about your ideal client, take a look at our Marketing Master Mini Class, where in less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity on your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. Access the Marketing Master Mini Class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. In our discussion, Gleb talked to me about aligning emotions with values, with culture, and with long-term goals, and at the same time, not basing decisions on emotion alone. He shared his 8-step decision-making process to overcome any cognitive biases that might otherwise impact decisions negatively. And he shared his 5 key questions to avoid decision disasters. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Dr. Gleb Sipirsky. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Columbus, Ohio in the USA, Dr. Gleb Sipirsky, who's a cognitive neuroscientist and an expert on behavioral economics and decision making. Now, welcome to the podcast, Gleb. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Thank you, Jürgen. I really appreciate you inviting me.
Gleb, now you're the CEO of Disaster Avoidance Experts. You consult, you speak, and you train all around the world. And your latest book is Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters. And in that book, you focus on cognitive biases that business leaders have, and you reveal how leaders can overcome these dangerous judgment errors effectively. So I'm really looking forward to exploring that in some more depth with you today. It is a fascinating book, and I certainly recommend that our listener checks that out, and we'll have links to that later on in the show notes, of course. But before we start talking about all things business decisions and judgment and cognitive biases. Tell us a little bit about your own background. How did you get to where you are today, and what were some of the moments that shaped that journey?
Well, with my journey, actually, my exploration of decision-making began as a kid when I saw my parents making some pretty bad decisions. Yeah. So that's actually what got me really interested in decision-making, because I saw my parents fight a lot. They're both gut-oriented people. And what does it mean to go with your gut? What does it mean to follow your intuition? It means that when you feel something is true, you do it. When you feel something is true, that means it's right. And then you do it or you believe it and so on. And both my parents were like that. They felt something was true and then they did it. But unfortunately, very often their guts opposed each other. So for example, my mom liked to have nice clothing. She thought it was important and valuable. My dad was kind of a cheapskate. So when she would go out and buy a $50 sweater and she'd come home, my dad would yell at her and say, no sweater should cost over $20. And they had a lot of fights like this. You know, that was just like an example of one sort of fight that got out into like a bigger issue. And they had a lot of little conflicts. And already as a kid, I saw that it was harming the relationship. They were stressed. It wasn't helpful. Didn't really change behavior. And so I was already wondering, why do they do that? That seems dumb. Not, if not in those, quite in those, you know, mental words. But that was my feeling, that this is something wrong. Something's wrong here. But it got really acute when there was this big situation. My dad was a real estate agent, so he worked, had a variable salary based on commissions. And there was this period of about 6 months when he made a lot of money, but he told my mom he made very little money. And he hid this money from my mom, and he invested into buying a house elsewhere, an apartment elsewhere, leasing it out to some people for a couple of years until my mom found out. When she found out, there was a huge, big blowout scandal. She really felt she couldn't trust him, you know, with this sort of monetary issues, very challenging monetary issues. They already had their little conflicts. This was a huge one. And so they actually ended up separating for a while. And I ended up living with my mom, of course, and saw my dad pretty rarely for a while until they reconciled, but she could never really trust him again. And that really shaped me as a kid. That really got my attention and really told me that, hey, my adults aren't gods, my parents aren't gods, and they make some pretty terrible decisions, financially speaking. And that made me really want to learn this. So at the same time, as I was growing up, you know, this was in my early teenage years, I was born in 81. So I came of age around the dot-com boom, when the companies like Webvan, Pets.com, Boo.com were really booming and tech leaders were partying like it's 1999, for those who remember that Prince song. I mean, maybe that ages me. But anyway, just a couple of years later, after the partying in 2002, was the dot-com bust, when all of those business leaders of these companies who were in the front pages of the Wall Street Journal for the right reasons in 1999 were now there for the wrong reasons in 2002. So I saw how people who are heroes of tech industry can go to become zeros. I mean, we have some examples of that. Look at Adam Neumann at WeWork, you know, going from hero to zero. And we can talk about that. So even worse were the people who used malicious accounting fraud to hide their losses from the dot-com boom. I'm talking about Enron, Tyco, WorldCom, the leaders of these companies, some of which, you know, don't exist right now because of that, unfortunately. I mean, the tech leaders had a lot of bad decisions that weren't malicious. And there were a number of bad decisions. We can go into that and explore it. But the leaders of Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco used maliciously bad decision-making to hide their losses through accounting fraud. And it was so dumb. It was so completely irrational. Look at what happened. I mean, they only staved off the inevitable by a year or two. They were discovered. They were in the front pages of the Wall Street Journal in handcuffs, going to jail for a very long time, just getting out, you know, within the last couple of years, some of them. For one more year of bonuses, they gave up, you know, 15 years of freedom and a great deal of money that they could have made. So it was completely irrational decision-making on their part. And that made me especially fascinated and very concerned with, you know, where is our society going? Why are people making such bad decisions? My value set was always utilitarian, still is, wanting the most good for the most number and reducing suffering. So it made me want to address that. And I went into studying decision making. So I became a trainer, consultant, coach. Once I started learning about this, started teaching others. And then I went into academia. So I decided I need more available than was just available in plain literature and decision making. So I went into the cutting edge research in cognitive neuroscience and behavioral economics, which has only been recently becoming available as we are understanding how the brain works. Only in recent years can we understand how our brain causes us to screw up and make bad decisions because of some of the advances. We can talk about that. So that is where I've spent 15 years looking, studying in academia, publishing in peer-reviewed complex journals, very dense stuff, in how do we actually make decisions, how do we address the problems in our decision-making, how do we fight the cognitive biases that lead us to make such screwed-up decisions. And so that's what my new book is about, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters. It looks at leaders at all levels, whether aspiring leaders or leaders at the very top and everyone in between, solopreneurs, professionals, and so on. How do you make the right decisions and avoid the wrong ones in your business, in your career, in your finances? And that is what the book is about, and that's what my work is about.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's a really great journey there that, you know, you've gone through a couple of, I guess, what was probably a quite traumatic experience in your childhood with your family. And then later on, maybe less traumatic, but still reminding you of bad decisions that affected you more directly. So,
yeah, it was disenchanting with, you know, these leaders of titans of industry. Now that was really disenchanting.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder, you know, with you gave the example of the dot-com boom and people suddenly, I wonder if when people suddenly achieve success, like it was almost an overnight success in those days because they tapped into the right need and the timing was right. And it was indeed a boom, the dot-com boom. And some of those folks thought that things could continue like this, so that I wonder whether the expectation that this sudden success would come from everything they did actually was one of the cognitive biases. I know you'd, I don't think you'd talk about this one specifically in the book, but I wonder whether, you know, impatience is one big factor here. And I think in today's world, it just seems to me that a lot of people are going to business, particularly in the internet and online business world, and thinking that, you know, if they do A, B, and C, they'll be an overnight success. And they kind of forget that there's actually a lot of hard work to do, and there are a lot of decisions they need to make, which they can't just kind of go with their gut, as you say.
That's a very insightful point. So I do talk about related biases that shape all of this in the book, the overconfidence bias, the optimism bias, the normalcy bias. And we can talk about each of those. But there are specific biases which explain why people react badly in these situations of sudden success. And it applies not simply to these top leaders. I mean, think about any sort of bubble, the dot-com bubble, right? There were a lot of ordinary folks who bought into the idea of the dot-com bubble, and then they lost their life savings. There were a lot of folks who bought their house in 2007 because they thought housing prices will keep going up, right? Going up. Same sort of thing. Right now, a lot of people are buying stocks because they think, you know, we have a bull market that must keep going up, and therefore they are going to eventually get in a tough situation because of this. So this is a constant aspect of human decision-making where smart investors like Warren Buffett and others who go against the herd make a lot of smart decisions, and they take advantage of people who are making bad decisions by jumping on the bandwagon and thinking that everything will be good and fine in the future. So this is one of the cognitive biases that leads to this. Is actually something I suffer from quite a lot. And so I'm going to be honest here. My biggest weakness for me is called the optimism bias. And this is a weakness for many people who are entrepreneurial like I am. So I'm an entrepreneur. I run a company, Disaster Avoidance Experts, like you mentioned, of six people doing training, consulting, and coaching. And many entrepreneurs, whether many leaders who are the top level, are actually quite optimistic. They see the grass as green on the other side of the hill, whether it's green or yellow. They see that they have exaggerated expectations about the future, which helps them inspire people, but also cause them to make the wrong decisions about the future. They have exaggerated expectations about other people, which helps, again, uplift those people, but also cause a great deal of conflicts as a result with these people. They are risk blind, so they will take some opportunities that they really shouldn't take. And sometimes they'll strike lucky, very often they won't. So this is where there's a very going to be an interesting pattern where the people who are more optimistic tend to succeed more, but then they tend to fail more. And so you will tend to see that the people at the very top, you know, whether entrepreneurs and so on, they will be the optimists. But what you won't see is all the optimists who didn't succeed and who are right now lost their life savings and working as a janitor in some startup somewhere, not in a good situation. So that is called the survivorship bias, where we look at evidence that we have and we ignore evidence that we should have, but we don't, about all the failures. So this is why a book written about why Jeff Bezos is great or why Bill Gates is great or why Elon Musk is great or why Adam Newman is great is not really going to be helpful for you. First of all, you know, if you write about how Adam Newman is great and then, you know, you miss the last chapter of his life where he throws up WeWork and it goes from a valuation of $75 billion to last evaluation of $7.5 billion, which is an order of magnitude difference. I mean, that's $68 billion of value wiped out. That's ridiculous. But anyway. So if you'll miss that. You'll miss what happens later. And sometimes people who are heroes will be zeros in just a bit. And the more importantly, you miss all the other people who tried to do what they did and failed. And right now, where are they? You know, it's like all the players who tried to get into the NBA. It's the same sort of situation. You know, you have a lot of young people who try to get into the NBA, who try to become the top-notch football players, who think that that's how they will make a living, you know, young people. We can look at them, I mean, not quite laugh at them, but we can be, you know, okay, your chance of becoming an NBA player is, you know, maybe 1 out of 1,000 and something like that, making a professional career playing football or baseball or something like that. And the reality of an entrepreneur becoming the next, I don't know, Elon Musk or someone like that is also incredibly low, probably less than 1 out of 1,000, probably more like 1 out of 1,000,000 or something like that, maybe lower. But all the entrepreneurs think that that's realistic because they're too optimistic. And there's, due to survivorship bias, they ignore all the failure stories because nobody writes a story about how he went to Silicon Valley and failed. And nobody buys those books, right? Even if they were written. Yeah, so they don't get written. So that's a big problem.
Yeah, and I think there's another big issue there, and it comes back to what we were saying earlier about the expectation of rapid success. And that's, you know, whether you take an Elon Musk or a Jeff Bezos and you read their story and you say, wow, that's pretty inspiring. And, you know, you look at the huge success that they've had and say that in itself is aspiring. So I want to be the next Elon Musk, let's say. But what people forget, and I don't think what really comes across clearly in a lot of those biographies about those folks. Now I'm generalizing here because I haven't read them all, but what I think doesn't come across is just the amount of sheer hard work and effort that they've put into it. So yes, they've tapped into a certain need. They were in the right place at the right time. They had good connections, and there's lots of other things in their story that people can model off. But I think the expectation that I'll just do all the good things and be optimistic about what's going to happen, and then I'll be the next Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. But forget about all the hard work that, you know, these guys often, and I know I was reading about Elon Musk, I think he works about 21 hours a day, doesn't need any sleep, which, you know, that would challenge most people. So so there's something already. And this gets forgotten in the decision-making as well, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a really important point. And you forget about all the grind and hustle that they had to put in. So there's two elements that you need to realize. You have to be being smart, being very smart, and all of those folks who are at the top have to be very smart, is necessary but not sufficient. Being very hardworking is necessary but not sufficient.
Yeah.
You also need to be very lucky. Yeah. All of those people, there are lots of people who are very smart, who are very hardworking, but who aren't lucky. And the chance of you being hardworking, smart, and lucky are very, very small. So this is not the model to emulate. You know, this is not a model that you want to emulate. You want to look at the reality of what is actually going to happen to entrepreneurs. And if you look at the reality of entrepreneurialism, you'll see that about half of all startups fail within the first 5 years, about two-thirds of all startups fail within the first 10 years, and about three-quarters of all startups fail within the first 15 years. I can guarantee to you that you're incredibly more likely to be part of the 75% that fail than be the next Elon Musk.
Well, that's just statistics, isn't it?
It is, but people don't believe it. You know, I tell you this, and somebody will hear me and they will nod their head along with me like I'm nodding my head, and then they will completely ignore it. You know, it'll go into one ear and out the other, and internally they will feel like they will be the next Elon Musk. Because, and here's the kicker, cognitive biases don't work on the level of reason. Cognitive biases work on the level of emotions. And our emotions determine about 80 to 90% of our decision-making if we just let them go and just go with the flow, which is what the vast majority of people do, because their decision-making process is, I'm going to go with my gut. I'm going to go with how I feel. If I feel that one way is the right way, then I will do that. And they will ignore anything that says differently, because whatever they hear that goes against what they feel doesn't feel right. And by definition, of course, it won't feel right because it goes against your emotions.
Yeah,
it will feel uncomfortable. And the vast majority of people are very uncomfortable and refuse to get outside of their comfort zone and hear information that is challenging to them. So if I say, you know, don't go with your gut, check with your head, large majority of people will completely ignore it. They will check out when I say that, because they're like, well, my gut is doing the right thing and I will, you know, my gut is going to lead me in the right direction. And me giving you the statistics on 75% failure within 15 years, definite absolute statistics that, you know, you can't really argue with it. People will just say, I'm definitely going to be in the 25%, you know, and this is, it gets to the ludicrous stage where, let's talk about overconfidence. If you ask college students, there was a study done on college students, they asked, how good of a driver are you? Are you below average? Are you average? Are you above average? Turns out that 93% of college students are above average drivers.
According to now, their own assessment.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, of course. Yeah. But it doesn't only affect college students. It affects everyone. So there was a study done on professors, not simply college students, on whether you're a below average professor, average professor, above average professor. Turns out that about 90% of professors are above average professors. Same thing applies to lawyers. Same thing applies to all sorts of categories of people. Mm. We feel greatly overconfident about our abilities. And that is a big, big danger, because we're much more likely to be in the 75% than in the, you know, 0.001% of Elon Musk. So there. Yeah.
That's a fascinating observation. And I was listening to a podcast the other day from Oscar Trimboli, who is the host of the Deep Listening podcast, and he's been on the InnovaBus podcast as my guest as well. And he quotes similar things. So he says, you know, everybody thinks they're an above average driver. Everybody thinks they're above average intelligence. Everybody thinks, and this is his point, because he's focused on deep listening. So everybody thinks they're a really good listener. And yet, you know, it's kind of skewed, because that can't be right. I mean, at least half the population must be below average. Otherwise, it wouldn't be an average. Yep. So, yeah, so that there's that overconfidence. I would like to go back, because one of the things you mentioned was that we, you know, a lot of our decisions are based on emotion, which is kind of the, I guess, one way of putting going with your gut. How do you feel about that? And there's, to me, there's various decision-making processes that different people have. And a lot of the time, the decision-making is influenced by emotion, but the question is, where does that come in? A lot of people do make decisions based on emotion first, and then they go through some sort of process of rationalizing that decision with facts and statistics. So talk to us a little bit about your process. I know you have kind of an 8-step decision-making model, and you have a bunch of key questions to ask when going through that. But talk to me a little bit about, how does everyone discipline themselves to start off with the putting the emotion aside, going through the rational decision making, and then, you know, then you can check in with your emotion afterwards. I think that's quite different than doing the emotion first, because you've basically then, when you do the rational assessment, you're filtering out a whole lot of stuff that doesn't fit in with your emotion, as you've pointed out.
Yeah, I think you're very much right. It's very important to avoid the rationalization, because exactly what happens is what you identified. We tend to not notice, without noticing this, we make the decision already. You know, one of the biggest problems, let's say, with interviews, is when you have just an interview that's unstructured interview, when you have one person talking to another for an employment interview, we have extensive evidence that that does not work in actually having a good hire, because there are some people who are great at doing interviews and who are very bad at the job, and vice versa. So who are very good at the job, bad at interviews. But when you do an interview with someone, what you'd get is whether you click with this person, not whether you will work well together. Mm. And very often, the people we click with are exactly the wrong people for us to work with. I click with other optimists because I'm optimistic. Yeah, yeah. Now, what happens if I'm surrounded by optimists? That means that everyone of us just has like 20 ideas before breakfast, and every one of us has their head in the clouds. And that's terrible for a business, because you're just going in all different directions and you're building up each other's optimism, and you don't have a filter for actually figuring out which ideas are workable. So the best people for me to work with are pessimists, where I have 20 ideas before breakfast. Pessimists are terrible at coming up with ideas. They are great at evaluating ideas. So I give them the 20 ideas and they say, you know, maybe these three are workable. You know, here are 20 half baked potatoes. These are worth finishing baking. And then they evaluate the ideas, they improve them, and they take them forward into something that will actually make a sizable impact in the future, whether it's marketing content or whatnot. So that is the way that you want to work. You want to surround yourself by different people, but that's not what happens when you just let your intuitions lead, when you let your emotions lead. So it's just one example of where people make big mistakes. So what you should do instead is make sure that your emotions determine your long-term values and goals. So what do you want to achieve? What's your sense of meaning and purpose? What do you value? That's where your emotions are in place. So that is the key area for your emotions. What kind of values do you have? But how you get to them, that's for your goals. That's for how do you achieve your goals? That's for your reason. That's for your rationality. That's for your logic. And there are two methods that I want to share. One is for quick decision-making in the moment on any sort of thing that you don't want to screw up in everyday decisions. You know, whether you're writing an important email to a client, or you're preparing for an important meeting, you know, something like this, any of these things, whether you're writing important articles, anything that you're doing, important marketing thing, but not something that's major, not something that's life-changing, you know, not for making a key hire. It's not for deciding on the next big product for your company, not for deciding on a critical supplier. So these are the five questions you want to ask for any everyday decision that you don't want to screw up. So what you're doing is taking out problems, minimizing risks. You're not maximizing success. You're just getting to a good enough decision. And the first question that you want to ask about any decision you don't want to screw up, that you want to make sure it's good enough, is what important information haven't I yet fully considered? So what evidence haven't you taken into account? The reason to ask this is that we tend to look for evidence that confirms our beliefs and ignore evidence that doesn't. That's called the confirmation bias. So you want to go against that. You want to specifically look for evidence that goes against your preferred choice. Try to disconfirm your preferred choice. Try to show that you're wrong. And if you can't show that you're wrong, you're great. But if you can show that you're wrong, that's very important, because then you'll revise your plan going forward. So, second, what dangerous judgment errors haven't I yet addressed? So there are over 100 cognitive biases out there. You can take a look at the list of cognitive biases in Wikipedia. And of course, my book, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters, looks at the 30 most dangerous ones in business, career, and finances, and how you can address them effectively. And there will be different ones applying to different situations. So if you're doing risk assessment, optimism and pessimism are going to be big ones. If you're looking at information, confirmation bias, survivorship bias will be important. Third, What would a trusted and objective advisor tell you to do? So think about someone who's a trusted and objective advisor to you. What would they suggest you do? What would that little angel on your shoulder tell you to do? You get about 50% of the benefit by asking this question, just by asking it, because you take yourself outside of yourself. You think about it from the perspective of, you know, what would you tell a friend to do about the situation? And of course, you get the other 50% of the benefit by, you know, calling this person, or if you're a millennial, texting this person. Next, fourth question. How have you addressed all the ways this could fail? So let's talk about email to a client. What if your client is in a bad mood? Think about what would happen if they read your email from a hostile perspective. So try to, after you write the email, read it from a hostile perspective and revise it accordingly so that all the ambiguities can be taken out. This is something that I struggle with because I'm an optimist, and it's very hard for me to imagine someone reading my email from a pessimistic, hostile perspective. So this is something I have to know. I have to work on this quite a lot to look at things from a hostile perspective. And there are a variety of ways that each decision can go wrong, so you want to look at them and address them in advance. Finally, what information would cause you to change your mind? So what evidence would cause you to revisit your decision? When we're in the decision-making phase, we're cool, calm, rational, and collected. Now, when we're implementing it, we're very attached to the decision. We're very emotional. So it's much harder for us to change our mind and revise our mind, revise the decision effectively. But if you decide in advance that, let's say, if your client doesn't respond in a week, you will call your client. So that could be a specific decision-making point for an email. That way, you won't spend a week or more biting your nails and waiting for what your client will think about the important email. You just let it go, and you go forward with whatever else you're doing, and then you know that in a week, you have a revision point. Now, these are the five questions for avoiding risks, making good enough decisions. There's a separate 8-step model, which I will take a pause before going to, for any major decision that you want to not simply make good enough, but that you really want to squeeze maximum value out of it, because it will be seriously impactful for the long-term future.
I guess one of the things that struck me when I was reading through the book and read those five questions, if your emotion has, so let's say you've written an email and it's come from kind of, here's what I feel, I'm just going to put it out there, send this proposal, whatever it might be, and then come back and read those questions. How do you overcome the filters that are already now, or how do I overcome the filters that are already now in my mind when I then ask myself those questions? Because if I start off, what important information did I not consider? Well, I didn't consider it before, so how am I going to see it now? What judgment errors didn't I address? So how am I going to see those now because I'm asking myself these questions? Trusted an objective advisor? Yeah, I can see the value in that, particularly if you actually talk to the trusted and objective advisor, because they don't have your biases. So I can see the value in that. But I guess my question is, how do you break through that barrier of, here are my biases, and so how am I going to answer myself honestly with these questions and not be filtered through those biases?
So that's a very important point, because ideally you would ask these questions before you get to the decision. These are the questions you ask before you make the decision, because when you make it already, when you have written the email, it's much harder to pull away your emotions from the already written email. So this is why it's very important to ask these questions before you make the decision. Now, some of these questions will still be applicable. Let's say you made the decision, you wrote the email, and then you're like, I need to ask myself these five questions. So you want to go back and look at the email and say, okay, what information haven't I considered? Oh, maybe I haven't considered, what's going on with my client. Let me go on LinkedIn, check, their LinkedIn profile. Maybe they posted something about what's going on with them recently. So let me look at that information. So that might be something that you can go through and look at information that you haven't yet considered that might be relevant to the situation. Now, what way can you address all the ways this email could fail? You could still rewrite it. You could still revise it. You could still think about, here are ways that this email could fail. So let me take some time to revise it and so on. And of course, you can still send this email to a trusted objective advisor and have them read it and give you feedback on it. So that you can still get on some of the benefit of these questions, but of course, ideally, you would ask them beforehand. So what I have is I have my clients and other people who read the book. What they generally do is that they print out the 5 questions and they have it on the table in front of them when they're doing their work and so on as a visual reminder to ask themselves before email, whatever scheduling, so on, because of course we do a lot, most of our work in front of our computers now. So that's a very good reminder just to visually have those 5 quick questions. And it takes only a couple of minutes to ask these questions. It can save you many, many, many hours and many, many thousands of dollars if you don't ask those questions.
Yeah. That's a good point to kind of begin with the questions rather than with the decision, with an emotional decision. All right. So now you mentioned the 8-step decision-making model for something that's a bigger decision, like let's say you want to purchase a house if it's a personal thing, or move offices, or put a serious proposal in that involves a lot of upfront investment before you actually realize the benefit or the income from that. So what is that 8-step process and how does that work?
So first, what you want to do is identify the need for decision to be made. And this is an important question because a lot of us don't identify the need for decision to be made. So you talked about, let's say, you know, moving an office. I've seen a lot of small entrepreneurs who have stayed way too long at their office, even when they have overgrown the needs of the office. It gets all stacked, it gets all, you know, piled up. There are more people in the office that can reasonably fit into it, but they still don't move because they're still busy with their everyday things and they don't really take the steps to evaluate their physical space needs and address the problem, which is a pretty serious problem of moving. So that's one example that you want to think about. When do you want the decision to be made? Let's take another example. Let's say somebody is sort of stuck in a dead-end job. I've had a coaching client I was speaking to who got passed over for promotion time and time again. And, you know, there are a number of reasons. She doesn't have a college degree. She got to her place by skills, and she's worried about, you know, people with a college degree who are younger, who are getting hired above her. So we talked about how her skills are a good fit potentially for starting her own business or finding a different job elsewhere, but she's really worried about making the jump. And I'm pointing out to her that she is, what would happen if she stayed in this position for 5 more years? Where does she imagine herself being 5 more years from now? And she really couldn't imagine herself in this position. She just had this visceral, very negative reaction to the idea of staying in this position for 5 more years. But if she just keeps doing what she's doing, I pointed out, she will stay here. She will not move. She will not change anything. And that really helped her understand that she's not making the decision that she needs to make that would help get her to her goals in 5 years from now. So those are examples of where you need to identify the need for a decision to be made. Next, gather relevant information from a variety of perspectives on the question at hand, especially people with whom you disagree. So if I'm an optimist, I should gather information from pessimists. If you're a pessimist, make sure to gather information from optimists. You want information that you don't consider that will disconfirm your biases. So go against your biases, go against your intuitions. You don't have to listen to the optimists or the pessimists, but you want to consider that information. You want to have that information as part of your analysis and give it more weight than you intuitively would. Now then, you want to decide on the goals you want to reach. Paint a vision of the outcome that you want to achieve. If you're going to be, let's say, moving your office, what kind of an outcome do you want to achieve? You don't want to achieve an outcome where in two years you'll have to make another move, right? Look at what will happen in the long-term future and make sure that you prepare for that with whatever serious decision you're making. Or let's say a serious proposal. Let's say you're investing a lot of resources into a RFP for a client, for a consulting client that's competing for a number of things. You want to paint a clear vision for the client of the kind of outcomes they would achieve in 5 years. Not simply say, here are all the awesome methods that I would use and I'm so great. You want to paint a clear vision for the client of what benefit they would get from getting you as part of the team, from hiring you for whatever you're doing. Next, develop clear decision-making criteria of what you want to achieve. So let's say if you're moving your office, you probably want criteria like the cost of the new place, the closeness of this new place, let's say, to where you live, if that's to however important it is to you and to other people who are in the office. You want other aspects like, let's say, amount of light in the office and niceness and comfort. So all of these things, decide how important they are to you. You know, if cost is less of an issue than commute time, if you really value your time that much, then you can value cost at, let's say, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is low, 10 is high, you could value cost at 7. And you can value commute time at 9, depending, again, on what is important to you. Next, generate viable options that can help you achieve your goals. This is somewhere thing that I see so many leaders, so many entrepreneurs fail at very badly because they go for the first viable option.
Yeah, they get excited by the first one. Yeah, which is emotion, right?
Oh, it's very emotional. Hmm. They get excited about this. This is the key hire who I should hire. This is the place for me to move my office, and so on. They get very excited about it, and they just relax, and they just go on, and they say, okay, this is it. This is good. Let me go on to the next one. What they don't realize is that major decisions, what you want to do for a major decision, you don't want to use the same process that you use for small decisions. They use the same process. They go for a good enough decision, and they don't realize that this is a bad time for a good enough decision. This is not the right time for this for the good enough decision. You want to make as good a decision as possible. You want to make it as close to perfect as possible, because think of all the impact that you will have from the space that you choose where your office will be for the next, you know, 20 years. Mm. It will shape. So let's say your commute. If you have a commute difference of, let's say, 5 minutes each way, that's 10 minutes a day. Now, what is 10 minutes a day to you? Let's say, you know, you, that means, let's say, go to the office 5 days a week. That's 50 minutes a week. And that's, of course, 2,500 minutes per year. So that's a lot of time difference for, even if it's a 5 minute difference in commute. So you want to really think about these things, and they add up over time. And of course, 2,500 over 20 years is going to be, what is it, 50,000. So that's going to be a lot. You want to make sure that you evaluate the difference and evaluate the outcome over the long-term period. So, and then you want to have that variety of options, and you want to have at least 5 viable options that you can compare. And then you can compare them on your criteria. So some places will be closer for your commute. Let's say importance of that. Some places will be more sunny and more comfortable. Some places will cost less. So you want to evaluate them on the criteria that you chose and weigh them comparing the criteria. You know, if a place is 5 minutes away, but it costs twice as much, then you want to think about how much is that worth it for, you know, the cost that it will be over 20 years versus the, you know, 50,000 minutes that you would save for a closer place. So you want to weigh these things. You want to monetize them ideally. Then the next step, this is step 7, you implement the option you chose. Now, there are 2 steps to this one. One is the failure, avoiding failure. So think about all the ways this could fail, this decision for a new office, all the ways it could fail, and address them in advance. Maybe you want to, you know, scope out the place at night and make sure there aren't like problems or drug dealing going on there. I don't know. You know, maybe check it out, make sure that there aren't like barking dogs by there at odd hours when you plan to be working, for example, and other things like this. So that's the first part. You want to avoid failure, address all the problems and in advance. The next part that you want to make sure, and this is what you want to do. You want to maximize success. So think about all the reasons that this might be much more awesome than you think it would. So let's say you choose a place and it turns out to be really great because it aligns with the future of your business for the next 15 years, 20 years, whatever. It turns out to be a very good fit for some reason for the future. You know, maybe you have a logistics business and you have more business coming to the area, and so you buy a place larger than you anticipated, but it really works out. So think about all the reasons why this might succeed and address all the potential for success. So let's say you buy a place that is currently not close to you for the new office, but you plan to move closer to it. So that's another way that you can address this issue. So that will you want to maximize success, you'll lower your commute. And finally, this is really important for those large decisions, less important for the good enough decisions that I talked through last time, previously, but this is incredibly important for the large decisions. You want to have clear metrics for evaluating the success of your decision. So what would it mean for an office to be really successful? That means that you successfully get there in the commute time that you planned. You know, if it's going to be a surprising amount of traffic and you find out that you really screwed up, maybe you want to somehow figure out that how can you revise this decision? You want to make sure that you have clear metrics that you track the success of your decision. So let's say in a year, you'll want to have spent each day on average 15 minutes less in commute. Let's say you got an office in a place that's near a forest and you will take walks every day. That's your intention, to take walks every day for half an hour, and you want to evaluate whether you did that. And of course, you can enable your employees to do all the same thing and so on. So more life balance, better exercise, better health, lower healthcare costs. That's important too. So you want to be able to evaluate whether the things that you thought you would get from this decision, the way you would avoid failure, the way you would maximize success, whether you're actually getting these things. And you know, you have an opportunity to revise things as you go forward, depending on the decision. You know, it's kind of harder to revise moving an office, but you know, easier to revise making a key hire or something like that, because you can retrain this person, give them professional development over time. So those are the 8 steps that you take if you want to maximize the success of a decision. You should use those for any major decision.
Mm. Well, thanks for walking us through those 8 steps and being really clear with that example. So I think that's a good example, and I'm sure that the listener can abstract other examples from that. One of the things that occurs to me is, you know, people have different ways of taking in information. And I'm sure as a neuroscientist, you're well aware that that's the case. How do you get people that perhaps are more kinesthetic in their approach to things or more visual in their approach to things so that they're really fast decision makers? How do you get them to go through a process like this to kind of slow down or, you know, leave the feeling aside for now and go through this process?
It's less about being kinesthetic. It's more about setting up the right reminders. So what we're talking about here is we're changing our mental habits. And this has to do with where our mental habits come from. Now, our gut reactions, our intuitions, are actually not adapted for the modern business environment, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
They're adapted for the savanna environment, when we're hunters and foragers living in small tribes of 15 people to 150 people maximum. That's why we make fast decisions. That's the fight or flight response. In the savanna environment, it was incredibly important for us to jump at 100 shadows in order to successfully flee from that one saber-toothed tiger or fight an attacking tribal member. In the modern business environment, you'll see many less saber-toothed tigers.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're still tempted to make that same very quick decision, fight or flight response, even though it's very harmful. Think about somebody, let's say you have a client giving you constructive critical feedback. Now, the natural thing to respond to that client is with a defensive response or an aggressive response. Defensive response meaning shutting down, ignoring the client, whatever, saying the client is completely wrong. The aggressive response is to respond to the client saying, no, you're completely wrong. Shut up. I don't want to hear you. Both of those would be really bad if you want to have a client.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to be able to make sure to incorporate your client's feedback and improve your performance based on the client's feedback. That is how you retain clients. But it's completely not intuitive. It's completely unnatural. So you have to develop that mental habit. And and those people who don't develop that mental habit go and work in corporate. They don't retain clients. You know, they aren't able to be small entrepreneurs. They can go and work in the corporate sector and, you know, have the marketing and sales department get them clients, and then they, you know, do their internal work, whatever. So in the same way that many people have retrained themselves to be able to deal with this constructive critical feedback because they need to in order to survive as entrepreneurs, You've also retrained yourself, many of you have retrained yourself to avoid eating all the sugar that you get your hands on. Now think about this. In the savanna environment, it was incredibly important for us to eat as much sugar as possible when we found this source of fruit, let's say. Because if we didn't, you know, we would not be the ones who survived and thrived in our tribe and wouldn't be able to pass on our genes. So right now, we have a very strong impulse to eat as much sugar as possible when we come across it. That's pretty terrible in the modern world. You know, Dunkin' Donuts serves donuts in a box of dozen donuts because they want you to eat all that sugar. They know that it's very tempting. And this actual serving of donuts shouldn't be more than one, you know, two max. So you need to be able to restrain yourself, go against all these temptations in the modern world in order to have physical fitness. In the same way, right now, what the researchers is discovering on the brain, you know, we found out that information about a dozen donuts, you know, within the last century, 100 years, when the research showed that it's very bad to be overweight, it's really not good for your health. Now we're figuring out that mental fitness is just as important for the health of our brain, for making good decisions, as physical fitness is, as avoiding the dozen donuts is the same thing as avoiding the go with your gut of advice. So what you want to do, whether you're kinesthetic, whether you're visual, and so on, is focus on developing those healthy mental habits of using these tools, using these structures. So create reminders. If you're a visual person, create visual reminders. Create mind mapping reminders that will help you remind you to avoid simply going with your intuitions and to look for information visually and so on that goes against your intuitions, that goes against your feelings. If you're a kinesthetic person, do the same thing. Create kinesthetic reminders. Maybe you want to create something on your keyboard that you can touch, and that will help remind you to, oh, hey, I shouldn't go with my intuitions on things I don't want to screw up. I want to go for an effective decision-making process. So that's what I would say for people who have these different learning styles. It's all about creating healthy mental habits. It's all about growing your mental fitness and avoiding the dozen donuts of advice of going with your gut.
Yeah, that's a really good point about the habits. And I like your analogy there with the sugar. And of course, building habits, I mean, we all build habits. And it's just a case of let's choose to build some habits around decision making, which I think is what your core message is.
Yep, that's exactly right. You need to build healthy mental habits around decision making. And the five questions that take just a couple of minutes to go through, or the eight steps that take, you know, half an hour to an hour, those are all mental habits that you want to build in and integrate. And of course, identifying your cognitive biases. So my book in chapter 7 has an assessment that helps anyone go through all of these 30 cognitive biases that are the most dangerous ones for business, finances, investing, careers, and figure out which ones they're most prone to and their workplace is most prone to and address them. So for me, the optimism bias is one of my biggest. I have some others, but that's one of my biggest ones.
Yeah, that's great advice. And that really is a good assessment. All right, well, this is fascinating. It's been a wonderful conversation, but I think it's a good point now to move on to The Buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that'll inspire our listener to go and do something awesome today as a result. So what do you think is the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Decrease their amount of fear and anxiety. I think fear and anxiety has been shown to be one of the biggest blocks to innovation. So if you look at kids and they're asked, you know, what can you do with a paperclip? They can find 10,000 things they can do with a paperclip. Whereas adults can find about like 5 or 10 things they can do with a paperclip. So because they're afraid of looking foolish, they're anxious about it. So you want to decrease your fear and anxiety if you're going to be innovative and create innovative products, innovative solutions, innovative ideas.
The paperclip exercise is always a good one, isn't it? We've done that quite a lot in my corporate days and training things. And yeah, it's always amazing how few things some people come up with, but then also how way out of the box some ideas are that you think, well, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah, that those would tend to be the more of the optimistic people who are less fearful.
All right, now what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I've made sure to work with pessimists because, again, I have 20 ideas before breakfast and they all seem brilliant to me. And that's dumb. They're not all brilliant. I know that rationally, but my emotions, my intuitions feel that they're all brilliant. So I make sure to work with pessimists and run my ideas by them to actually make sure that whatever ideas I develop and take to the next stage from, you know, have baked potatoes to more baked potatoes are worthwhile.
Yeah, I love that. The idea of having people that think a little bit differently than you and running ideas by them so that they can challenge those ideas, and often that'll improve the ideas. Or as you say, if you've got 20 before breakfast, filter out filter out the best ones, because often if you focus on 20, you're probably not going to succeed with any of them, even if 10 of them are good ideas.
And they're not.
All right. Now, do you have a favorite resource you use a lot?
Well, I have two answers. One is for, you know, branded product. I use Trello a lot. So Trello is a great product. It's just a note card system in electronic format, and you can organize things very effectively in that way. So if not for, and again, not an affiliate, don't get money from Trello, but yeah, I really like it. I use it extensively. For not branded product, what I do is I have a process where I do a morning journaling, where I look at things I've learned from the last day. I look at habits I want to build. It's basically a CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy style journaling, where I improve my ability to constantly be a lifelong learner, actually put it into action. You know, lots of people say they're lifelong learners, but you know, if you don't put that into action, you're not actually lifelong learning. You know, just reading a bunch of books and not retaining information is not going to make you a lifelong learner. Actually figuring out what you've learned and how you implemented them into your activities is what makes you a lifelong learner. And the same thing about habits that you want to build up. So I make sure that I develop my habits and I evaluate how well I'm doing with developing habits over time in my morning journaling.
Yeah, that's a great point about the learning, that you know, you can read a lot of information and discover new information, but until you actually incorporate it into what you're doing or make use of it in some ways, it really will disappear. It'll be very short-term learning. Okay, now what's the best way to keep a client on track?
What I find is the best way is to over-communicate. Now, this is important because one of the cognitive biases that we all suffer from is called the illusion of transparency, which refers to us assuming that other people really understand what we're talking about, understand our messages, our communication, whereas other people, according to extensive research, understand much less and intake much less of what we say in the way that we say. They filter it for their own filters, they ignore some of it, you know, they're thinking about what they're going to have for dinner. So what you need to do, what I find I need to do to keep a client on track and, you know, going forward with my coaching clients, consulting clients, is to over-communicate, make sure that I ask them whether they actually understood what I'm trying to say, not quite in those words, but, you know, asking them to, hey, what did you take away from what I'm sharing? And I try to figure out whether they actually took away what I think I would like them to take away or not. So making sure to over-communicate and check on the reception of my message has been the most important thing I find.
Yeah, that's great advice. Yes, I think we often ignore the fact that the way we communicate actually is what determines how people hear us, and fail to take responsibility for that. Okay, now what's the number one thing you think anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
This might seem a little cliche, but I want to encourage people to align their motivations, their emotions with what they're doing. So this is, and the thing that you want to figure out and remember is that your emotions are flexible and changeable. You can shift your emotions over time if they don't align with the kind of things that you would like to accomplish in the world rationally. But if you don't align your emotions, your values, your feelings together with what you're doing in your professional life, then eventually you're going to get burned out. And that's a big problem that increasing numbers of people are suffering from. If you don't find meaning, if you don't find purpose in what you're doing, if you don't find that sense of fulfillment. So I think what you want to do is make sure that you find that overlap between something that is emotionally fulfilling and satisfying to you at the same time that it is actually financially productive. And remember, again, you can shift your emotions, you can change your emotions, but you want to make sure that you find that overlap effectively and that you do the things that will help you be fulfilled over time in the long term, because you will not really have a happy life if you don't. And this is one of the things that something that you mentioned, I want to make sure to bring up about Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and other people like that. Often what happens with those people is that their personal life is very unhappy. And they, you know, Elon Musk's personal life has been struggle. I mean, Jeff Bezos is, you know, he just went for a pretty terrible divorce. So how much is their wealth worth to them as opposed to their personal life and happiness? So you want to make sure that whatever you're doing is something that's fulfilling for you and that you balance your personal life with your professional life.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And it kind of comes back to aligning everything with your values. And you mentioned that you know, we can change emotions. So, I mean, a good example of that is if I wake up one day and I feel sad, I can choose to feel happy very quickly. But if I'm about to head into a work or a meeting that is totally misaligned with my own values, then of course it's going to be much harder for me to change that emotion from sad to happy.
Yes. Yeah, changing your emotion from sad to happy is possible in the moment, but if you have systematic causes that cause you to be sad, you will gradually sap away the willpower that enables you to change your mood from sadness to happiness. So you want to make sure to take care of those systematic causes, or you should change what you're doing to make sure that those systematic causes cause you to be unhappy are not actually there.
Yeah, address the environment. Okay, and this is important for mental health, which we talked a little bit about earlier as well.
Absolutely.
All right, well, this has been a fascinating discussion, Gleb. Thanks for sharing all this with us. Now, where can people find out more about you and also get a hold of the book?
Well, my book, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters, was published by a great traditional publisher called Career Press. So it's available in physical form in bookstores everywhere, your local Barnes & Noble, university bookstores, indie bookstores, and of course, online on Amazon, again, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, wherever you get your books. You can check out my work at disasteravoidanceexperts.com. Again, disasteravoidanceexperts.com. There's articles, blogs, videos, podcasts, decision aids, manuals, assessments, online courses, consulting, coaching, and training services available. Make sure that you also check out a free 8 video-based module course. So 8 video-based modules on decision-making, Decision-Making 101, called the Wise Decision-Maker Course, on disasteravoidanceexperts.com/subscribe. Again, disasteravoidanceexperts.com/subscribe, free 8 video-based module course. And finally, if you have any questions about anything I've shared, please ask me. I'm quite active on LinkedIn, so connect with me there. Dr. Gleb Tsipursky, GLEBTSIPURSKY.
Great. And we'll have all those links in the show notes so people can jump straight through. And also the book is available on Audible as well for those people that are, like me, fans of Audible. So I actually listened to the whole book as well as read sections of it while I was listening.
Excellent. Yep.
All right. So is there a single piece of advice you'd like to leave our listener in regards to being a leader in their field and in innovation?
Probably the most important thing is that you need to have emotional awareness. You need to get in touch with your emotions. You need to figure out where and how they're driving you to make some regrettable decisions, because our emotions are all driving us to make some regrettable decisions sometime. You need to be able to identify that, those cognitive biases, those dangerous judgment errors, step away from them and employ simple, effective, yet counterintuitive strategies to make the best decisions for your goals. And that all stems from emotional awareness of your feelings, of your mind, and that's what you really need to get in touch with.
Great advice. And it links in really well with what we've been talking about throughout the episode in terms of decision-making and making sure you don't make decisions based solely on emotion and then try to rationalize.
Yes.
All right. Well, finally, Gleb, who would you like me to chat with on a future Nova Buzz podcast and why?
I'd like you to chat with people who are experts in decision making and in emotional intelligence. So, for example, in decision making, there are a number of people like Daniel Kahneman who are very prominent in expertise and decision making. There are a number of people like Daniel Kahneman who are experts in emotional intelligence, because I think those are areas that not nearly enough entrepreneurs, not nearly enough people who are experts in marketing, they don't really think about these areas. And they really should be thinking about these areas much more, because these are skills that are applicable across all domains. And your growth in those skills will help you not only in business, but in life areas as well. I mean, in your relationships, in your marriage, you touched on that very briefly, but my next book, The Blind Spots Between Us, talks about relationships, personal and professional ones, how emotional intelligence and decision-making skills are incredibly important for those areas. So it will help you in all life areas, not simply business. And those are folks I think it would be great for you to speak more with.
Okay, sounds good. So we'll reach out to both of those Daniels and see whether we can have them join us on the InnovaBuzz podcast as well. So thanks again for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously. And thanks for walking us through your 8-step process and the 5 key questions we can use for the quick decisions that are perhaps, not life-changing, but the 8-step process for the ones that are life-changing, to make sure that we don't simply go with our gut and get bitten. So I wish you all the best for the future, Gleb, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that engaging and really insightful conversation with Gleb and took something away from his episode. Gleb gave us many tips on how to consider as much information as possible prior to any decision and getting different points of view than just your own, particularly if those views might contradict yours. I'd love to know what you took away from Gleb's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Gleb Sipirsky. That is GLEB. Sipursky, all lowercase, all one word, don't forget the silent T, innovabiz.co/Gleb Sipirsky. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Gleb there, as well as links to the Disaster Avoidance Experts website, the book, his LinkedIn profile, and the video course Gleb mentioned on our discussion, as well as the other resources that we spoke about. Gleb sent me a long list of people to invite to future InnovaBuzz podcast episodes, and I'm working my way through those invitations, so keep listening for those conversations. Remember to check out our Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. But most importantly, it will enable you in less than 30 minutes to gain absolute clarity about who your ideal client is and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. And if you'd like our help to go even deeper into marketing mastery, or our help with producing your very own podcast, even launching your very own podcast if you don't yet have one, then send me an email to jurgen@innovabiz.co and we can set up a quick call to have a short conversation and find out whether we're a good fit for one another. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast. We've got some more fantastic guests lined up, including Sarah McIntyre of Bright Inbound and Kathy Sallet from Performance of a Lifetime. Stay connected with us by subscribing to the InnovaBuzz podcast at innovabuzz.com/subscribe. innovabuzz.com/subscribe. Make sure you never miss another episode. It would also mean a lot to me if you leave us a review, because what you think matters. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions, or questions you have, so go ahead and share them in the comments below the blog post for this episode. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.